Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Yes, welcome along. It's another episode of Writer's Routine. This is the show where an author takes us through their daily diary and we find out how an idea got from their mind and then they planned it and plotted it and published it. This week, we're chatting to Gabriel Tallent. His book, My Absolute Darling, it's done incredibly well, been so brilliantly received. It was a Times Book of the Year, a Guardian Book of the Year, a Metro Book of the Year, a Sunday Times bestseller, and I simply can't move for people on Instagram taking a photo of the cover saying, you just need to read this. Now, Gabriel talks about why his debut was written from a place of sheer rage, why he wrote it spread out on his bedroom floor, working around a day job as well, and how he made sure that his protagonist, the emotionally and sexually abused Turtle Alverston, how he made sure that she was real and not at all caricatured.
Trying to write what you think a survivor of abuse is like, you try and write instead a real human being who is in a real human predicament, who feels and thinks about it the way you would feel and think about it.
All that and more, it's on the way on this week's Writer's Routine. Hello. Yes, thanks for giving us a listen. My name is Dan Simpson. Now, before we get started and before I forget, if you enjoy this episode, if you learn something in the chat that helps the way that you work, do me a favour, please, leave us a review on the iTunes podcast store. You know, fingers crossed, we've got some pretty big guests on the way in the next month or so, detailing their writer's routines. And it would be amazing if everyone who needs their advice could find it. And you can let them know just by getting on that iTunes podcast store and leaving us a review. You see, it really helps with the chart, which will boost us higher, which means more people can see us. Also, you can give us a follow on Twitter. It's Writers Pod. We're on Instagram as well, Writers Routine over there. And that's the best places for you to keep across what's going on the show. So you know exactly when those brand new episodes featuring some big guests are ready for you to listen to. Speaking of big guests, we've got one on the show today. Gabriel Tallent, he published his debut novel, My Absolute Darling, last year, and it's been just ridiculously successful. It tells the story of 14-year-old Turtle Alverston. She lives in the wilderness with her survivalist father, Martin, and he abuses her, both emotionally and sexually. And it's an exploration of her life and her search for freedom and whether she'll ever find it or not. Now, we talk about what forced him to write the book, how he worked a ridiculous number of hours across the week, spreading himself across proper shift work as well to earn money and get this down, and also why, when he first had the idea for the story, it very nearly made him quit and give up. He thought it was just too big for him. Now, it's quite an intense chat, this one, because Gabriel is quite an intense dude. In the best possible way, though. You see, he knows what he wants, and he knows how he wants to write it, and he's writing for a reason, because he feels he needs to do it. It's kind of in the same mould as my chat with Anthony Horowitz a few months ago now. If you've listened to that, you'll kind of know what I mean. You see, I've had a few people say to me, since that's been out, look, did you and Anthony not get on? I mean, just between you and me, you kind of seem to clash a little bit. And it's the complete opposite. It's so far away from that. With Anthony, it was one of the best interviews that I've ever done, for me personally, because he's speaking from a place of sheer passion. And I think that how passion is communicated energetically and enthusiastically, it can sometimes come across a bit abrasively, and people might misinterpret that as conflict, I think, every now and then. And that's the same with Gabriel. But that intensity and that focus, it gives way to some really eye-opening and help-filled answers. If you listen closely, deep down in the answers, in some of the philosophical points that we make, there is some advice there that you don't hear too often that can really help with your writing. Now, a quick warning, the passion and intensity, it does spill into the odd F word every now and then. So if you've got some kids nearby, if they're floating about, be aware that the language does get a little bit fruity. Also, in a sec, we'll get a top writing tip from an author who wants you to pay more attention to what's happening around you every day. So that's on in a little bit. First, let's get right to it and find out today's writer's routine with Gabriel Tallent, the author of the best-selling My Absolute Darling.
I was a working person while writing My Absolute Darling. And as a working person, it can be discouraging because you hear the sort of immaculate routines of professional writers, and it feels so extraordinarily out of reach and structured. And, you know, as we lived in a little fourth floor apartment in downtown Salt Lake, and we looked at probably 200 apartments and just picked pretty much the cheapest, right? Is a beautiful apartment in many ways, but in the summer it'd be like 104 degrees, and I didn't have a desk, so I just worked on the floor with my laptop. You know, you work in between shifts. You work whenever you can.
What were you working as at the time?
I was a server. First I was wait staff at the Alta Lodge, like a ski lodge in Little Cottonwood Canyon, and then I was absurdly fortunate to become a busser. I was working as a busser at the Copper Onion, which is a restaurant in downtown Salt Lake. That job was really good to me, and I mostly succeeded in working, you know, 20, 30 hours a week, which gave me some freedom to write.
The show's called Writer's Routine. If you're working jobs and then sitting down on your floor to get this done, talk to me about
a typical day. Yeah, but that's kind of what I'm saying, is that you don't always have, not everyone has the luxury of a routine. I think a lot of times we talk about writers' routines because what most people need, what many people need, is structure. They need to structure their writing time because it's hard to motivate. But if you don't have the luxury of a routine, right? Like in a lot of food service people, a lot of shift work people, people with stories to tell, their schedule changes all the time, right? That was the case with my schedule. It always changed, and so there is no routine. And what it means is, it means you have to write when you have the opportunity. I set a goal for myself. I was trying to write 30 hours a week. And you do that whenever you can. And I think one of the most important parts of that is you can't be too fucking particular about when you work. Right? You work tired. You work run down. You work, exhausted. You work tipsy. You work when you prize writing to such an extent that you say you will only write sort of in the best and the most immaculate condition. If you're a working person, what that means, that's just a death sentence. Because you don't have that luxury. You don't necessarily have the opportunity to write always when you're at your freshest. So you write instead when you can. And part of what I did was try to attack the sort of the sacred idea of the writer's routine and to change it instead into something that I did because I loved.
Did you need a constant around you? So if you're writing, as you said, when you're a bit tipsy, when you've just come in from the longest shift ever, did you need something to always be there to help you tell this story?
Yeah, that's a good question. When you talk about like writer's rituals or something, and for the most part, I regard writer's rituals as sort of a crutch. Like I think they're great if you have a lot of resources and your primary struggle is encouraging yourself to write. But if finding time to write is your biggest is your issue, then rituals become excuses not to write. That said, I did have one, which is that I would only let myself drink caffeine when I was writing. So I would drink coffee or like in the summer, because it was 104 degrees in the apartment, I'd drink like Red Bull or something like that, you know, because he's tired. And that was nice. Or green tea. The project unfolded over such a work of years and changed so much in the writing and in the elaboration. There's no sort of single moment, because for the longest time, Turtle, who is the protagonist of the book, right? Turtle Alveston is the protagonist of My Absolute Darling, was the peripheral character in a novel I was writing. I can tell you the first time Turtle's character really appeared to me very clearly. I was in Scotland. I was I just hiked the West Highland Trail, and I've been walking for a long time, and I just had I hiked it with just a wool blanket, so it was kind of miserable conditions. But a couple took me in, and I was staying on Loch Shiel, and I was out sort of in the hills above the loch writing, and I wrote my first scene with Turtle. That was the sort of the first time that I ever used that character with that name.
So tell me about what it originally was then. If you said that Turtle was this peripheral character in stuff that you were writing before,
why did she come to the fore?
Yeah, why did she become more than this peripheral character in an original story?
I felt that Turtle had the most at stake in the book. And so it was wrong that the book was about other characters. Like the book was dominated by male characters and was this sort of brainy novel about environmental destruction. And that seemed to me unjust, because Turtle had the most at stake, was the most imperiled. Her plight meant the most.
So then what did you do? So you've decided that I'm going to make Turtle the star of the show. I'm gonna strip it all back. I'm gonna tell her story now.
Yeah.
Then what did you do? How did you develop that? How were you planning? How were you plotting?
I decided to quit writing. I thought that it was gonna take about 5 years of work. I was about right in that. I thought it was gonna be huge labor to tell that story in the way that I wanted to tell it, and I was daunted. I thought that I should quit writing and seek a career, because it set aside a little time after school. What I really wanted to do is I wanted to get a PhD in 18th century cultural history. It was sort of my passion. Yeah, so after school I set aside like a year to write, and that of course got out of hand. But when I realized how much longer I had with the book to make it into the book that I wanted it to be, when I realized that Turtle had to be the protagonist, when I realized sort of how serious the stakes were going to be, when I realized how much work it was going to require to tell the story and the way I wanted to tell it, I thought that I couldn't risk it, that I would be better off going into a graduate program and getting a degree and having stability in my life.
What drew you back into her then?
Well, I called my mom, and I called Elizabeth, and I told her the story, and I said, look, you know, it's climbing really seriously at the time. So we talked at length, but one way that I put it is, I'm sort of like, I feel like I'm high up above gear here, and there's sort of no end in sight, and I think I better retreat off this thing. I think that I better like go into a career because I don't know if I'm going to be able to do this. And she said that I should take the risk, that I was young and I should take big risks for what I believe in, and that if I didn't take the risk, I would always regret it. All I could do is work hard. I don't know that I'm working in the right way. I don't know that I'm telling the story in the right way. There's no. Sort of have no instruction manual. That's not true. There are great manuals about writing. Stephen Koch, The Modern Library Writer's Workshop, is a fantastic book about writing. So there sort of are manuals, but I don't know that what I'm doing is right. I don't know that what I'm doing is on the right track. And so I decide early on that labor is all I have to spare, that I can just work like hell. So to like not be afraid to waste labor. So I'm like, any good idea that I have, no matter how crazy, I will just work at it. I'm like, you know, if this seems like it might work, I'll put 200 hours into it, 300 hours into it, see if it can be made into a scene, you know, write this scene and rewrite this scene and rewrite this scene endlessly, see if it can be made into something. And if it can't be made into something, then all you've had is writing practice. I have some idea that it is a young woman's fight for her own soul, right? That this is a book about sort of the terrible and insidious toll that abuse takes and the logic of it, right? The logic is that abuse is dehumanizing. And so survivors of abuse have to search for and sort of claim their own agency and humanity. Look, I shouldn't be generalizing, right? Because people go through all kinds of different experiences and have all kinds of different struggles. But in the case of this particular young woman, this is a particular young woman who is being dehumanized and is searching for a vision of herself as her own young woman and not as her father's, right? Her survivalist father, and he's this toweringly charismatic, autodidact, and a person who is to his daughter immensely impressive and controlling and sexually and emotionally abusive, and he's killing his daughter. He's killing her because he sort of can't help himself. He's a deeply wounded person who is by turns very passionate and eloquent and inspiring and loving, and by turns his worst self, wounded, selfish, devouring of her. And it's about the struggle of living with that, of living in the company of someone who sees you not as your own person, but as an extension of themselves, as chattel to which they are entitled. And so it's Turtle's fight to be her own person, and that requires her to turn against the person who means the most to her in the world and who is to her a person of such persuasive eloquence that it is also impossible to imagine that she could be right and he could be wrong about something, right? So it's a story about, it requires her to trust herself and believe in herself in sort of escalating acts of physical and emotional courage. That's the story I wanted to tell, and I just had to put that on the paper scene by scene, and you work at it.
Now, this may sound like a ridiculous question, but you just said, after you gave me this incredibly eloquent, floral description of what your story is, you said, this is the story that I wanted to tell. So how did you expand it enough in your head for it to become what you've just described it as?
You have to remember that I have a whole other book that I put in a drawer, right? So I had Turtle as a peripheral character in that novel, and when I realized that I wanted to write Turtle's novel, I had her as a character, and so I just started there. And when you have Turtle as a character, you pretty much know her plight.
When you're putting her front and center, how do you make her a completely believable, relatable, three-dimensional character? Because taking someone from the edge and sticking them right in the center, this story's now about you, changes the focus of what you're doing.
Yeah.
How did you make it clear?
For me, how you do that is you pay careful attention to Turtle as herself as a young woman. You try not to write a survivor. You try not to write what you think a survivor of abuse is like. You try and write instead a real human being who is in a real human predicament, who feels and thinks about it the way you would feel and think about it. Oftentimes when we think about other people, we do a sort of emotional rounding down. But the project of writing for me becomes the problem of making other people alive, and as difficult, as complicated, as thoughtful about their own lives as we are, as embattled as we are, and you write towards that and you read the scenes that you've written and you think, is this a real person or am I cutting corners? And when you know where you want to go, you cut corners. When you know what you want to say, you cut corners. Because that's not what writing is. Writing isn't didacticism. Writing fiction isn't the simple transference of it's not the fictionalization of an essay, right? It's not I have a simple idea and I'm putting it on the page. Rather, the page is the most complex, most nuanced, most difficult instantiation of the idea. So you ask at every moment on the page, is she as difficult and as alive, as thoughtful? Does she have the dignity and innocence that a real person has in this predicament?
You know, I love that as a description of writing, that it's not simply moving an idea from your head down onto the paper. It's more the exploration of that idea on the page. And you're almost just the conduit for these things that are happening around you. You know, all the characters and the themes and the emotions and the traumas that come with your story, they're almost not yours to govern. They're the pages. I hope that doesn't seem too deep and worthy. Stay with me, we've got more gold and insight from Gabriel Tallent just like that in a sec. And next, we've got a top writing tip that may change the way that you work forever.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Right, time for this week's writing tip that may change the way that you work forever. This is when, after the interview proper is over, I steal like another little bonus minute of our author's time to eke out one final piece of advice for them. It's a little tip that helped them get their story down, and hopefully it will help out yours. Today, we've got an observational comedic drama author on the show who wants you to pay more attention.
Hi, my name's Keith Anthony. I've written Times and Places, which is available now. I've been asked to give one writing tip. For me, I think what really helped me with my book was just to have a little notebook and to go out into the world, whatever I was doing, just to spot those really small things that happen, those characters that you see, just to make a little bit of note of them. Because what I found in my book was that when I came to write, I was able to look back on that, and out of those small seeds, you're able to create with your imagination, who might this person be? Why might they have been sitting in the road begging? What might have led to that? And you can create a character from just really small, almost unnoticeable things, but it's those unnoticeable things which perhaps can be the most poignant.
So thanks so much then to Keith Anthony. You can check out the episode all about how he wrote his debut novel, Times and Places. It's over on the website right now, riotersroutine.com, or you can grab it through your favourite podcast place. Let's get back to our chat then with Gabriel Tallent, who's the author of the best-selling My Absolute Darling. Now, earlier on, you heard all the accolades that the novel has got so far. You know, it's a Times, a Guardian, a Metro Book of the Year. Let me very quickly, before we get back into it though, read you this from Stephen King. He says, "There are books that we like well enough to recommend, but there are very few, maybe To Kill a Mockingbird, Catch-22, The Things They Carried, that we seem to remember forever." And Stephen says that to his own shortlist, he can now add My Absolute Darling. The word masterpiece, he says it's been cheapened by too many blurbs, but this novel by Gabriel Tallent, it is absolutely one of those. I ask him about what he thinks of that a bit later on in the chat, and how he would like his work to be remembered, and what the point of his story actually is. Why has he written it? Also, we unpack his characterization, how he made Turtle and her abusive father Martin believable and relatable, and whether, in some cases, that was even the right thing to do. And we pick things up talking about the story's roadmap. This is something that authors in the past on this show have mentioned to me, how they plot their story as if they were driving a car, so you know where you need to go. But for Gabriel, at what point did his plot make itself visible on the road ahead of him?
I find that when there's somewhere I'm trying to get, I pay less attention to the scene where I am. Like, you railroad the plot towards that, right? You're like, I'm moving towards this particular scene, and away you go. For me, I try and ask in the moment, what is she thinking? What does she do next? Like, right, if you know where you want to get her, then her actions at any moment are sort of set, and you can sort of just stage direct her through them. But I found that didn't work as a strategy for me. For me, I would be writing a scene, and the most important question of the book is, what does Turtle do next? And it isn't always what you want her to do, right? Because you're trying to privilege her as like a person, as difficult, as unpredictable, as a person. She's not a chess piece that you move through the board trying to get to different scenes. She. You have to render her emotions. So you sort of follow where that goes. In as moment to moment way as possible. Sometimes you have an idea of events, but most of those big events that I wanted, I dropped from the book, because it's the most important thing is to closely examine and render Turtle's experience, not to check plot points.
What about the biggest plot point then? What about your final plot point? What about the end? How long did this story take you to write?
Well, probably not very long. You know, I for the most part write in long pushes. Probably 3 or 4 months, maybe.
And at what stage in those 3 or 4 months did you figure out how it would end?
It had a different ending in the first draft. I had some sense of where it might go, and I found it out when I found out for sure when I got there. There are certain things that I felt were morally true, because like, I didn't want Turtle to be rescued. I knew that a lot of readers object to this, that Turtle just would be rescued. This is what we want to think is true about our world, about us. And it is just my experience that hasn't been true. And so I thought that I can't write in a happier ending than I think is real, right? And I can't make it easier, because abuse and misogyny is insidious, and violence against women is real and saturates every level of our culture, and controlling male rage kills people, kills women every day in my country. And there's no sidestepping that. But as for the particular things of how things fall out, I try and take it moment by moment. In every draft, I read through Turtle and I think, I think, where am I getting her right? And where am I relying upon stereotypes or imagined ideas or what I want to be true or what I think is true or what would be cool if it were true? Or where am I foregrounding aesthetics over thorny or more difficult to approach emotional ideas? I did a lot of revising for that. And as I did that, the plot changes, you know. The book is about Turtle's about her emotional struggle. So the more granular and particular you can get about that, the more that dictates the plot. Because a lot of books are about the scarcity of technical or physical resources. Like, well, a character doesn't know how to do a thing. Right, but Turtle is a character of immense resourcefulness. The problem in the book isn't what she can do; it's what she has the courage to do, what she has the emotional clarity to do. And that determines everything. Like, a lot of people are very interested in Martin. I do whole interviews that are all about Martin, and I don't find. I don't find that compelling. I don't think he's an anti-hero. I don't think any of that stuff. Martin is a weak person, right? And you need to get it on the page, but you need to show why she loves him. You need to show why it is she holds out hope. You need to make that emotion come alive for the reader. Otherwise, you haven't succeeded in your project. Otherwise, you've suggested that the plight of people who love the person who hurts them is one of foolishness, is fundamentally non-understandable, right? Or that these people are different from the rest of us. No, you say you try your hardest to make the reader feel ambivalent about that, because then you've made Turtle a person like them.
You say you know exactly how you want your reader to feel about a particular character. How are you making that clear with the craft of your storytelling? Talk to me about the language. How much do you concern yourself with what word is coming after the next?
Sometimes a lot and sometimes not very much, you know. I write following flights of inspiration. And then I revise and revise and revise. I read through the draft that I've written, and I go, does this feel like a real person? Is this a real emotion, or is this something else? Am I trying to be cool? And then you throw out everything, and you keep in your heart the real emotion that was the part of the scene that was good, and you rewrite it. Trying to put that emotion in every line, and you pursue it and explore it, and like kind of dialectically throughout the scene, right? Trying to evoke in the reader the emotional insight that is the heart of that moment.
What's the purpose of the book? What's the point of your story? Is it simply to tell Turtle's tale? Is there a grander vision with the whole thing?
I mean, you get into a tough philosophical problem because things don't have innate purposes, right? Like, why do I do it? I do it so that some young person pulls this book off of a dusty bookshelf and the book matters to them. The book speaks solace and dignity to them in a way that they hadn't seen it before. That's success for me. And if I never know, That's success. But if the book means and something and speaks solace and comfort and dignity to someone, if someone sees Turtle's dignity and in the light of that sees their own, you know, we can see something about fictional characters that we cannot see about ourselves. It can be tremendously difficult. Like, the logic of abuse is so dehumanizing that it can be tremendously difficult to see our innocence and to see dignity, to really feel that. But when you do it in a book, the situation is contained enough that throughout everything that Turtle does wrong, right? Because we hold survivors to account for so much that they do wrong. And that is so much of what we want to know. But Turtle does everything wrong, and that's not what people say about Turtle. What people say about Turtle is she's so strong. But, you know, Turtle colludes in the abuse of another child. Turtle is lost. Turtle feels at fault. Turtle stays with the person who hurts her. She does she makes these critical mistakes, and yet I think that most readers, what leaps out to them about her is her innocence. Throughout all the moral darkness of her circumstances, they see her innocence. And that's the project. And if they can see that about a character, perhaps that casts their own innocence in a different light. Sometimes we feel culpable for what we have done wrong, but don't see it as we would see it in another person, right? So you try and put insights like that, like you try and see something true about abuse, and you try and put that true thing in a book, in fictional circumstances, in fictional people, in made-up things, so that it's clear there in a way that it's sometimes not elsewhere, and you hope that a reader sees that about that character and sees that in their life. That's what you hope for. Some of the most important people to me in my life, and some of the writers that I value the most, write books that you have not heard of. So when I think about what it means to write and to be successful, I think is shaped by that. Great books go unknown, unlauded, and sometimes they don't stand the test of time. You do your best. You tell the best story that you can. And the rest of it is not under your control, and it is not why we do this. It is not. You know, I wrote from tremendous rage. Not everyone I grew up with is still alive, right? People, like, we are out here in the world playing for keeps. Not everyone seems to act like it, but we are. And I'm still alive, and I have the luxury to write to an issue that I care deeply, passionately about, right? An issue that keeps me up at night, and it feels like something I can do. I can tell a story about this thing that matters to me. That's a luxury, and a way to fight, and a way to stand by my principles, and a way to argue for my way of seeing the world. Misogyny is rotting us from the inside out. And it is everywhere. And we think of violence against women as the work of lone wolves and sick people, but violence against women, like the most profound femicide and rape and the most horrendous crimes, which affect some of the people closest to us. This is not the work of sick people. This is an extension of the logic that is found everywhere in our culture. And to be able to speak out in whatever small, minuscule, unmeaningful way against that is, I don't know what to say about it exactly. It's not a pleasure, but I have the luxury of doing it, right? And it's good to do something that you feel is meaningful. So I do it because I have to, and because I want to, and because if it matters, like I said, to that one kid who pulls that one book down, then that's enough for me. I was that kid pulling books down off bookshelves, and they meant the world to me. And you think those authors will ever know? No, those authors will never know. But those authors wrote with passion and heart, and those books changed how I saw the world. And that's magic.
When your first book's been compared to Kill a Mockingbird, what do you do next?
You just keep writing as best you can. I mean, think about who's doing that. That guy writes so much fucking words. He that is a person who labors, right? Who labors long and seriously, and who values those labors. Look, I don't know any other metric but to write the best books I can. And the rest of it is out of your control. You can't start worrying about that stuff. You follow your passions. You follow what seems to you to be right. You write ethically. There's nothing else for it.
Finishing there with Gabriel talking about Stephen King and being amazed at just how much he writes. Huge thanks to Gabriel then for sparing an hour of his incredibly busy time at the moment. This book is a ridiculous bestseller, so for us to get an hour in the same room together, I really appreciate it. His book, My Absolute Darling, it is out right now. It's massive, it's been critically acclaimed all over the place, and it just feels like one of those books that you think might live on forever. You can find out loads more about it right now over at writersroutine.com. And thanks to you for listening. We'll be back in a couple of weeks, hopefully, with more tips from some of the best authors around. Now, to keep across when new episodes will be out, the easiest way is to give us a follow over on Twitter and on Instagram, and to check back to the website, writersroutine.com, because we'll have some updates over there as well. And as always, in the next few weeks, if you do find a spare minute, a review on the iTunes podcast store is always helpful. It can let other authors know that we exist. And I'll see you again next time. Thanks so much. Bye.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.